Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. Many of you, no doubt, have seen the hot steam geyser Old Faithful in Yellowstone National Park. That's geothermal power. A consortium of agencies in Oregon announced recently plans to tap geothermal reserves, hoping to generate 150 megawatts of power. Also this time, Florida Congressman Dante Fussell, looking to the UN summit in June and on some points of disagreement.
Well, the first thing that one considers is the difference in philosophy of how you approach these problems. And it doesn't take very long to see what the gap is. Population control. You could almost stop right there.
The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. Officials in Oregon are counting now on broad creative citizen involvement in a proposed energy project near Bend, Oregon. The federal Bonneville Power Authority, together with California Energy Company, Incorporated, a private firm, and Oregon's largest public utility, Eugene Water and Electric Board, have agreed on a deal to produce at least 30 megawatts of electricity from natural steam deep in the earth. And some geologists suspect there may be enough geothermal steam available to produce hundreds of megawatts of electricity. David Sokol is president of Cal Energy.
Okay, well, I think this agreement with the Bonneville Power Administration is very important in that while we have had active both discovery and operation of geothermal power generation in California, Utah, and Nevada, this will be the first significant scaled project in the northwestern United States, which is an area that is rich in geothermal resource and increasingly having a larger demand for clean power generation. So I think that we see this pilot program and this is one of the first projects, you know, very important to demonstrate to the people of the Northwest that you can generate power by harnessing some of the Earth's natural energy without having any adverse environmental effects.
Cal Energy, the nation's largest independent producer of geothermal power, will finance exploration. Eugene Water and Electric Board, or EWEB, will fund and build the generating facility. Bonneville Power Authority, BPA, in operation of the Federal Department of Energy, will market the power. Although the project is on paper only at this point, Gary Kunkel, Director of Power Management at EWEB, says it has been a learning experience for everyone.
It's very exciting to us. We're looking forward to being a partner with a private company. We don't do that too often, although we're exploring opportunities more and more now that we're working with cogeneration facilities in private business. And it's a challenge for a public agency like ourselves to kind of dance to different tunes. But at the same time, we're learning a great deal about often how to do things more efficiently.
George Darr, spokesman for the Bonneville Power Administration, says BPA, in its approach to geothermal power, is enthusiastic but cautious.
Well, one of the problems is that unlike the hydro system, where you usually go in with 30 years or something of hydrology to give you a sense of what your fuel supply is like, that is relatively unknown in geothermal. In fact, that's one of the reasons why you have a pilot plant that is relatively small, so that you can run the plant for a year or so and flow the wells and get a better sense of the reservoirs before you make commitments to additional plants. So I guess from a utility standpoint, there is that unknown about the resource is one of the hardest parts of developing geothermal.
The proposal is to build the project just outside the boundaries of Newberry National Volcanic Monument, established recently near Bend, Oregon. As Sokol explains, the project is very much dependent on the site itself.
Geothermal energy typically, at least as we know it here in the United States, occurs along a fault area, an area where the Earth's surface crust movement, plate movements have created opportunities for the molten rock or magma from the center of the Earth, if you will, to move in closer proximity to the surface. In some cases, it actually manifests itself through a volcano. But when it gets close to the Earth's surface, it then can be overlain by an aquifer or a a rock with water-bearing formation that with this hot mass of rock underneath it gets heated up, and the energy from that resource can be tapped and used for geothermal.
In 1970, Congress passed the Geothermal Act, among other things, giving companies and individuals rights to geothermal potential, the way companies or individuals can own mineral rights. Since then, there has been incentive to explore and develop. Sokol further describes the plan.
The aquifer, if you will, or just envision a bunch of crushed stone, let's say 6,000 to 8,000 feet below the surface of the earth, that has, it's filled with water. Underneath that is this molten rock, which transfers its heat up through the rocks and has boiled or pressurized that water. And what it is actually high-pressure hot water and high-temperature hot water because of the earth's soil on top of it, and it's not having access to the atmosphere. It can't just turn into steam. And so we then put wells down into the ground and tap that hot water. Now that it can reach atmospheric pressure, it steams. We take the steam and put it through a turbine generator and then put it right back down to the same location.
And what happens then to the area once you're drawing that pressure off and drawing down the temperature? Do we know anything about what, in the long term, the geological effects would be?
Well, we do from similar applications elsewhere. We have a large facility down in Central California, and we have two other facilities, one in Utah and Nevada. The key to geothermal energy, which is what classifies it as one of the renewable energy sources in the country, both wind, solar, and geothermal, is that you only extract the amount of energy that the underlying molten rock masses can replace without depleting the energy resource of that steam field. For instance, if you liken it to a pot of water on a stove that's boiling, if you dip into that pot, take out about a half a cup of water and replace it with a half a cup of cooler water, that pot continues to boil. But if you try to take out a half a gallon of that water and replace it with cold, it will stop boiling until it heats back up and then boil again. And the key to geothermal is to only extract the amount of heat that is already being transferred through the rock structure so that you don't ultimately have any reduction in overall underground temperature.
We asked David Sokol to stay on the line for a moment. There was another key player in the Newberry project, the Northwest Power Planning Council. The council was formed by Congress in 1980 to help settle growing disputes over who is going to get dwindling Bonneville hydropower reserves in the Northwest. IOUs, investor-owned utilities, or the public utilities. Ted Halleck is current chairman of the council.
We are not a federal agency, nor are we a state agency. We're something in between. We're a sort of regional government without portfolio. Our powers are limited to basically persuasive powers, with the exception of having been given the right by Congress to pass on the acquisition of any new generating mode of more than 50 megawatts which Bonneville Power Administration plans to acquire. So we have, in effect, a veto power over some of the work the Bonneville Power Administration does.
We digress briefly from the Newberry story. The council is really quite an interesting entity. Comprised of representatives from Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Montana, the council is a vehicle not only for settling disputes, but facilitating progress and innovation. Once again, Ted Halleck.
We are referees. We can command, that's a very powerful verb, but we can command the players to appear before us and do regularly and continuously on all subjects, ranging from their reliance upon natural gas, which is a phenomenon currently underway, to whether they're keeping their distribution systems repaired and up to date, to what disposition of nuclear power plants will be, will they continue online or go down, and on and on and on. Not because we have a subpoena power or any juridical power over them, but because of our persuasive powers. We create headlines, we make news. I'm talking to you 4,000 miles away about our activities. So within the region, the media is paying very close attention to us. So our power is one of sweet compulsion, and it works pretty well. The rivalries, the frictions, the schisms continue to exist, but we have to make decisions in the midst of all that.
The council is required to issue a new report every 3 years on the status and plans for energy in the Northwest. The most recently completed plan, taking the region through 1999, calls for increased development of renewable sources such as hydro, solar, wind, and geothermal. Which is why, now getting back to our story, the council supports the Newberry project. Opposition to the project is over expected intrusions on the land. Cal Energy says steps will be taken to minimize the intrusion, including constructing some of the facilities underground, if necessary. Others wonder about the effects of drawing heat from the earth. Returning now to David Sokol at Cal Energy, he says even if we drew all of our energy needs from the center of the planet, the effect would not be measurable.
The overall effect, if you will, to the temperature of the center of the earth, or the core, or even the crust levels of the earth, is de minimis, you know, to levels of accuracy that would not even be material. If you look at the mass energy inside of the earth, the amount of energy that we use as heat, electricity, automobile, etc., if we did it all with that heat, would be de minimis. And that the amount of power generated in the United States through geothermal energy is absolutely insignificant. Now, and that's true of, you know, whether you look at wind sources, geothermal, or solar, that while we have a, if you will, assumed closed universe of energy, what we have to do as a country is start looking at what are the best uses for our environmental energy sources, whether it's fossil fuel, oil, whether it's natural gas, whether it's coal, geothermal or other aspects or other types of energy sources, again, wind and solar included, what is the best mix so that we are depleting our overall energy sources at the lowest possible levels, and we are also causing the least potential damage to our overall environment? Because the one option that we don't have as a society is to just bury our head in the sand, which unfortunately many people have indirectly recommended, and that is just ignoring any form of energy production and just say, no, we're not going to do that anymore. And that's just not an option.
The United States currently has online about 2,800 megawatts of easily available geothermal power. The Electric Power Research Institute would like to see 20,000 megawatts developed in North America before 2000. The United States Geologic Survey says using high-tech extrusion methods, the western United States, including Alaska and Hawaii, might produce between 95,000 and 150,000 megawatts total over 30 years. Sokol says, as with any energy supply, here again we find ourselves challenged.
No source of generating power is perfect. Every alternative that we have today, from solar to nuclear power, has its benefits and its negatives. And our goal as a company is to find the best possible technology to produce the least cost power, and least cost being defined as minimized environmental effects and minimized cost, where the two are most compatible. So it's not an easy thing, and you know, frankly, from our perspective, it would be better never to have to alter the face of the earth to you know, satisfy any of the demands of our civilization. But you know, we don't have that option, and so we have to find the ways to do it in the least harmful fashion.
David Sokol, chief executive of California Energy Company, speaking to us from the corporation's new headquarters in Omaha, Nebraska. Also speaking today was Ted Halleck of the Northwest Power Planning Council in Portland, Oregon, and Gary Kunkel of the Eugene Water and Electric Board and George Darr of Bonneville Power Administration, both in Eugene. We began our story saying officials now hope to encourage citizen participation in this project. They base their hopes on how the nearby volcanic monument was negotiated. Reportedly, everyone from environmentalists to industry to recreational interests were involved in setting the boundaries and conditions under which that site would be established and controlled. It is hoped both the exploratory drilling and the full-scale pumping at Newberry would be done under a plan agreed to by as many as were involved in the monument project. This is Bruce Robertson. After 5 years of negotiations that began in Uruguay, 108 of the world's nations have failed to sign the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. The so-called Uruguay round of GATT talks, scheduled to end in mid-December in Geneva, reportedly ended as European leaders balked over demands by U.S. officials to reduce farm subsidies. This breakdown characterizes the challenges ahead as leaders work to restructure the world's political, military, and economic power. Yet, if nations cannot find new thinking on these issues, the biggest loser of all, in the end, says Florida Congressman Dante Fassell, will be the environment. During his 36 years on the Hill, Fassell has seen enough pass by his window to know the importance of the United Nations Earth Summit next June in Rio de Janeiro.
There's Chernobyl is one example, okay, poisoning the atmosphere across the space of many, many people. The fact that by the year 2000, there'll be another billion people on the Earth using up the environment. The frightening statistic that 25% of all animals and plants will become extinct or close to it in the next 30 years, and that tropical forests are being demolished at the rate of 40 to 50 million acres a year. And as I pointed out, that's an area as big as Minnesota, and that in some countries and continents, for example, the statistics show that in Asia, 90% of the waste is dumped in the water or close to it. And, you know, we're all living on the edge of the water. So if any country, for example, drops mercury into the ocean, we're all the beneficiaries of that poisonous drop. And this conference is coming up in Brazil next year is really a very, very important conference on environment and development. And it's one of the things that we tried to stress in our foreign aid bill this year, saying that we would cooperate with other countries in terms of assistance for economic development, but it must be based on environmental sustainability. We just don't want to go in there willy-nilly and provide assistance to other countries where it's desperately needed, but in the process, because of either lack of attention or interest, we're destroying the environment in the process. We say these things, as a matter of policies, these issues, that is, development and environment sustainability, have to go together if we're going to have any kind of future in our world.
In a recent essay to the Christian Science Monitor newspaper, Fassell wrote, "If we manage to steer aid and technology to developing countries, they must commit to following environmentally sound policies and actions." As chairman of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs, Fassell says he frequently has conversations
where people say, "Oh, great, you've already used up everything, and now here we are just coming into a free market economy and just getting around to mobilizing our natural resources and being a player on the world scene. Now you're telling us we can't do it." And it's a tough argument. So it's a hard sell job. But there is a general awakening across the world on the necessity for us to come together, that is, the people of the world, to try to deal with this problem. Otherwise, the best efforts that we can make in the United States, or any other country for that matter, will ultimately go for naught. We are forced to work together.
Congressman, what would be some of the major issues likely to be standing in the way of a truly united commitment coming out of this conference next June?
Well, the first thing that one considers is the difference in philosophy of how you approach these problems. And it doesn't take very long to see what the gap is. Population control. You could almost stop right there. Deforestation. How do you reinvigorate, and how do you get other countries to slow down based on what we know will actually happen if the land is deforested where it has actually occurred and it's turned to desert, you know. How do you proceed with development to provide the infrastructure that a society needs to maintain its people and do that with the minimum amount of damage to the environment in which that same society has to live? sustainable development is what that means. And it's that is a difficult issue. And when you are dealing with societies who have not reached the industrial level or the technical capability at which a major societies of the world have reached, I'm thinking now of Europe, the United States, and others, it makes it a very difficult conference. Fortunately, there's enough of a thread of understanding, even with the least developed countries and the societies around the world who are least able to deal with these problems, that they understand there are leaders who understand the absolute essentiality of working together. And that's why this conference is so important.
If these are some of the potential stumbling blocks, what will be the stepping stones? Fussell says, for sure, we will need to keep the dialogue up and not get bogged down in disputes over the shape of the table.
And we need to get to work immediately on what we, when I say we, I'm talking about the nations of the world that meet in this conference. What kind of legal mechanisms, what kind of structures will be effective, if any, in carrying out our objectives and our goals in this whole area? So we have to have a realistic set of not only principles, but a realistic set of goals and an agenda which runs into the next century. Otherwise, if we don't have a goal, if we don't have an objective, and we're not going to get anywhere. We're just going to keep talking. It's the kind of criteria that we have tried to put in some of our own legislation, where we legislate a goal in taking sulfur or carbon out of the air, that kind of thing, or cleaning up our rivers, et cetera, or a one-for-one replanting on reforestry. We, all of the people in this international effort, have to set some goals that are realistic and achievable and do that as fast as we can and agree on the mechanisms that are going to make that possible. And and then you got the collateral issues, which are also very important. What about the financial resources to do all of this, and where is the technology coming from?
Well, what kind of concessions will have to be made in dealing with the technology and the finances, for example?
Well, we're going to have to reach an agreement, as we have with everything else, when it becomes to an international issue. We will have to reach an agreement and an understanding of what everyone's contribution will be. And the industrialized nations will be called upon once again to pay their fair share of environmental know-how at an affordable price.
And what about the developing nations? What will they be called upon to do?
Well, they're going to have to make some contribution, and their greatest contribution, aside from some financial contribution, is to accept the technology and accept the guidelines for sustainable development. That's their contribution. In other words, they say, well, we can't put as much money into it, but we agree on the principles. We're looking to a better future in the world. We're willing and ready to cooperate.
Florida Democratic Congressman Dante Fussell. He is chairman of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs. Fussell has represented the 19th Congressional District of Miami, South Dade County, and on south to Key West since 1955. He spoke to us from his regional offices in Miami. This is Bruce Robertson. And that's our report for this week on the Environment Show. In coming weeks, a conversation with Judy Barry, seriously injured in a car bombing in the 1990 Redwood Summer protests. Also soon, news of a New England tropical conservatory to preserve biodiversity. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. You can always order cassette copies of The Environment Show. Call 800-767-1929. This week, ask for The Environment Show, number 105. That's 800-767-1929. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.